This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Coming up on the program today, we're going to handle an issue that is affecting more and more individuals as they get into their latter years of retirement, and that is planning for incapacity, whether it's some form of disability, impairment, or incapacity, whether it's dementia or Alzheimer's.
And I'm Kathleen Harris, and we're really excited today to be talking with Dr. Gary Small, professor of psychiatry and the director of UCLA's Longevity Center. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Brain Bible, and we'll be discussing with him some of his prescriptions for brain health in his newest book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, Keep Your Brain Healthy for the Rest of Your Life. Jim, I just want to insert a quick word about how what we're talking about today in terms of dementia and Alzheimer's relates to what we talked about last week, which had to do with smart estate planning and ways to title your assets. It seems kind of obvious that as someone ages and they get less and less competent, that their ability to manage their financial affairs gets less and less strong. So something we talked about last week was corporate trusteeship. We also talked about titling your trust and your assets properly. So just to kind of tie this all together, Jim, last week we talked about titling assets, smart estate planning, corporate trusteeship. As these issues of dementia start to crop up with someone that you love, these are things that need to be dealt with right away so that you prevent any problems with passing assets on or dealing with financial affairs. And the reality is there is a significant price tag associated with issues of mental health and aging. And there are several ways to pay for these particular issues. They involve increased nursing home cost care, increased doctor cost care. So there are several different ways to fund handling this particular type of issue. And so, Jim, why don't we cover different ways to fund issues of mental health that may occur when people age and talk about maybe some long-term care policies or annuities and other ways to fund handling mental health issues as you age?
Well, Kathleen, when we talk about long-term care or incapacity, we're really talking about three kinds of categories that make up this situation. One is skilled nursing, two is intermediate care, and three is custodial care. And the differences between those is when an individual moves from, let's say, their home to a long-term care facility, they now move from skilled nursing care to intermediate or what we call custodial care. And the one constant that I could say between all those three is they cost lots of money. Depending on where you're located, which state you live in, the national average can vary, and it's around $75,000 a year. It could be up to $200 a year. And once again, depending on, obviously, if you live in high-cost states like California, New York, let's say Massachusetts, the cost can vary anywhere from $50,000 to as much as $100,000. And Kathleen, you know, one of the things that we do in when we prepare a financial plan, a retirement plan, is we also run these health insurance costs, because these are one of the biggest costs individuals will be dealing with in their retirement years. And especially when they get, you know, maybe when they start out, they're in their 60s and they're in pretty good health. But as they age, they get into the 70s, maybe their 80s, these are the kind of problems they're going to run into. I wonder if you might talk about some of those costs and how significant they can be, because you run a lot of those illustrations.
Well, you know, a lot of the illustrations that we run, Jim, have mostly to do with physical health. It's very rare to see a lot of questions on those questionnaires about mental health, but even just taking into consideration physical health issues, if someone has had heart trouble or diabetes, for example, those healthcare costs can be in the $200,000 to $300,000 range for the course of care during your retirement years. Now, if you factor in someone who's having a mental health condition that requires skilled nursing care, you're going to be adding on somewhere between $75,000 to $200,000 per year of care for those types of issues. So if those types of issues run in your family, you'll want to be planning for an additional $75,000 to $200,000 a year in your later years. That's not an insignificant amount of money to be planning for, by the way.
No, absolutely not. And this is one thing that most people aren't thinking because, you know, most people when they retire, they're in pretty good health when they head into retirement, assuming they're not forced into retirement because of a health issue. And when you're feeling pretty good and nothing's wrong, you're not thinking about this. You're thinking about, boy, I'd like to go on trips. I'd like to, you know, what we call the bucket list. I'd like to see places I've not been able to do. I'd like to spend more time playing golf or sailing. And they're not thinking of, wait a minute, the government doesn't cover all my medical costs, and as I age, it's more likely those costs are likely to increase, whether it's drug prescriptions, it's time spent in the hospital with maybe a serious illness, or in the cases we're talking today, with dementia, Alzheimer's, and incapacity.
So, Jim, when we're talking about long-term care planning, what are some of the various ways people can actually fund the plan? And more importantly, when should they start doing the planning for their long-term care costs?
Well, obviously, if you're anticipating, retiring in the next 5 or 10 years, you're in your 50s, the earlier that you start thinking about this, and there's various ways that you can plan. And let me put this into perspective. If you have lots of money, you've accumulated a substantial net worth and you're well off financially, Kathleen, probably you don't need to do or plan for that because you're probably going to have the assets to take care of those kind of financial commitments should they arise.
So in other words, you're self-insuring your possible nursing care costs yourself.
Absolutely. And you're basically self-insuring because you have the assets to pay for this. But for a lot of people that don't have substantial assets, maybe they've accumulated enough money where they can maybe live comfortably in retirement doing the things they want to do on their basic necessity budget and on their bucket list, they're fine until an illness arises. And unfortunately, if you're thinking of long-term care insurance, obviously it's just like life insurance. The earlier that you take out a policy, obviously, the cheaper it's going to be. And we have an illustration. Now, these are just national averages. But for example, a 40-year-old could get a policy, two policies for both husband and wife, for as little as $83 a month. Fast forward to 50, still pretty much cheap. It's about $110 a month. But go forward into the 60s, it's $162 a month. And by age 65, it's $225 a month, and it really starts to escalate from the mid-60s going forward to the point where you could be paying $6,000 to $7,000 a year for a policy.
So, Jim, here's one of the problems I see with long-term care insurance. You just said that one of the most ideal times to buy insurance is probably between the ages of, say, 40 to 55. Well, most people I know that are that age are dealing with kids, they're dealing with work, they're dealing with shuttling people back and forth. The last thing on their mind is dealing with nursing home care. So talk a little bit about the reasons why someone should start thinking about it at a younger age.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in your 50s, as I mentioned, you're 50 years old, the difference for premiums for both you and your spouse only go up to about $110 a month in your 50s, maybe $123 at age 55, and even $160 a month at age 60. So if you know you've had, let's say, a history of dementia in the family or debilitating type diseases that you've seen that, let's say, are hereditary in the family, that's when you should start thinking about purchasing a policy. Now, Kathleen, the average stay in a long-term care facility averages about 3 years. So, you know, if you get a 3-year policy, maybe the ideal way would be to get a 4 or 5 year policy with a 1 year waiting period, meaning that if you did go into facility, the first year would be covered out of your own expenses. But, you know, that's the time you want to take a look at a long-term care policy, because that's when it's least expensive. That's when it's most affordable. And if you're not accumulating big bucks and you have a history of, dementia or Alzheimer's in your family, maybe you have a parent that you're dealing with this very issue today, that's the time you need to be thinking about it. But unfortunately, as you mentioned, Kathleen, people in their 40s and 50s, they're thinking about getting the kids through school, paying for college, maybe paying for weddings. And by the time you get into your 50s, you're thinking, man, I need to get some money saved up for my own retirement. So it's probably at the bottom of the list when it comes to planning for retirement. But that's when you should actually purchase a policy if you are not going to be able to self-fund, meaning you don't have enough assets to self-insure.
Jim, I want to point on something that you just said that has to do with, you know, family history of mental health deterioration issues like dementia, Alzheimer's. I remember you talking with me about your interview with Dr. Small, and he indicated that there's a 10% chance that people would have Alzheimer's by the age 65 and a 50% chance if they live to age 85. And I was also looking at an article in USA Today that came out recently that said that an Alzheimer's epidemic could hit the USA by 2050. So I guess the bottom line is that for most people, they should probably consider doing this whether or not they have, especially if they have Alzheimer's or dementia in the family, but they also need to look at it and think, if I'm going to be living into my 80s, mid-80s, 90s, my family has that history, I probably should think about the fact I'm going to have a 50% chance of having Alzheimer's, which is a significantly increased cost of nursing care.
Yeah, and that's what you're going to hear with this interview with Dr. Gary Small. But, you know, the interesting thing about it, Kathleen, is just like what any good doctor would tell you if you have, let's say you're overweight, you're predisposed to diabetes or heart disease, the doctor's going to tell you, look, you need to change your diet, you need to go and exercise, you need to do things and stop anything that's unhealthy for you. Let's say you're eating fatty foods, you smoke, or maybe you're having a little bit too much alcohol, the doctor's going to tell you, you know, take care of yourself. And that's the surprising thing you're going to hear in this interview with Dr. Gary Small, is only about 25% of the factors that contribute to, let's say, dementia or Alzheimer's are hereditary. 75% of that it has a lot to do more with one's lifestyle than it does, let's say, hereditary. His newest book, which I highly recommend, it's called The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, How to Keep Your Brain Healthy for the Rest of Your Life. There are exercises that you can do to really stimulate your mind. I can remember my mother-in-law was a bridge master, and I remember even before she passed away, she was sharp as a whip in terms of her memory skills because of developing her skills in bridge. And likewise, her mother, who lived on into her 90s, was also a bridge master. And Dr. Small's book talks about the things that you can do to sharpen your brain. The most important thing is a lot of this is preventative, and that's a key story here.
Jim, you talked earlier in the program about self-insuring. We've talked about long-term care policies as being an option for funding nursing care, but for those that have substantial assets, you talk about self-insurance. What exactly do you mean by that, and how should someone structure their assets that they have earmarked for long-term care?
A lot of this, Kathleen, has to do with having surplus income or, let's say, substantial assets. In other words, if you have a portfolio of dividend-paying stocks that are increasing their dividends over a long period of time, you know that your income stream is going to be increasing throughout your retirement. And that's a very important element to have in your portfolio, because you could retire and be well off today, but if everything you have is in fixed income, well, as inflation costs continue to go up, especially on the medical side, and they really have been going up quite substantially, if you don't have anything in your portfolio that is increasing in value, whether you have rental properties that increase rents, whether you have stocks that increase dividends, or the fact that you just have enough surplus income that you don't need it to, let's say you're not spending it all, so you're saving, then what you're doing is building a financial cushion that can take care of those needs should they arise later on in life. Another method that we've seen people do, because especially when people start thinking about this in their middle 60s, late 60s, early 70s, Kathleen, by that time, the cost of long-term insurance is so cost prohibitive. One method that has been used to plan for it is having annuities on, let's say, each spouse's life. So let's just take an example that there's a $100,000 annuity on the husband with the wife as beneficiary and annuitant, and there's a $100,000 policy on the wife with the husband as a beneficiary and annuitant. Now, you can allow those annuities to compound and grow so that if you never end up in a retirement facility, let's just pick on the husband. Let's just say the husband dies of a heart attack. Okay, so he dies suddenly. He is not impaired health-wise in terms of being put into a long-term facility. What would simply happen is upon his death, the annuity would go to his wife as the beneficiary. Now she has $200,000 in value plus any accumulation of returns over that period of time. But let's say the one spouse ends up in a long-term care facility. What you could do is annuitize the annuity, which would produce a tax-sheltered stream of income that could pay those long-term care. And we would usually do something like a 5 or a 10-year period certain, meaning that if you went into a long-term care facility, you and I know of a client that we had last year that went into a long-term care facility. He had Alzheimer's, and he only lived 6 months in that facility before he passed on. So if you had an annuity that had a 5-year certain, 7-year certain, whatever it was, if they made payments for 6 months, those payments would continue to the surviving spouse. So annuity is one way of taking care of it. I've seen couples that have used reverse mortgages. I have a couple right now that have taken out a reverse mortgage to take care of this expense. The added revenue that's coming in from a reverse mortgage is going to enable them to take care, or it's going to enable the wife to take care of the husband and yet allow her to still live in the house. They just didn't have the funds to, let's say, go into an individual annuity. Unfortunately, they thought about this too late, later on in their life, and when the onset of the disease started to develop, by then, it was too late. You couldn't get long-term care insurance. They didn't have the assets to self-insure. They didn't have enough assets in annuity, but what they did have going for them was a lot of equity in their home.
So, Jim, basically to summarize, what you've been saying is that there's sort of a sweet spot in terms of age when you should be buying or thinking about buying long-term care insurance sometime between the ages of 40 and 55. Once you move past that sweet spot, maybe you hit 60, 65, you're going to have to self-fund using some other method like putting money in an annuity that would later possibly be annuitized, or perhaps a reverse mortgage. So there's sort of there's the insurance company insurance option when you're younger, and as you get older, the annuitization option, and as you get even older than that, reverse mortgages. Have I summed up pretty much the ways to fund care costs, Jim?
You sure have, and I would say probably the best option is to go get Dr. Small's book, and that is prevention, Kathleen. You know, watching what you eat, making sure you have the right kind of diet, making sure that you exercise, and also go through the mental exercises that strengthen the brain synapses. You could take a bridge, foreign language. There are a lot of things that challenge. There's a company called the Great Learning Courses, where you can take, something totally different than what you did.
Luminosity.
Yeah, Luminosity. Take math courses online. Things that will stimulate your brain in a way they've never been stimulated before. And I'd highly recommend you can pick up Dr. Small's book. I ordered it. I got it through my Kindle. It's $9, and it is worth every dollar of it. So the best option of all, Kathleen, is prevention.
In this case, an ounce of prevention is worth about $300,000 in medical costs later on.
Absolutely.
So reading a book seems like a smart idea. So Jim, we've talked quite a bit about the costs of long-term care and how to fund long-term care. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the prevention side of long-term care and mental health. Coming up, we'll be talking with Dr. Gary Small about exercises and tactics you can use to prevent having to have these concerns crop up in your life. And Jim, as you mentioned, his book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, sells for $9 on Kindle. I got to tell you, $9 on a book now sure beats $300,000 of healthcare costs later.
Absolutely. So coming up next is my interview with Dr. Gary Small. Joining me on the program today is Dr. Gary Small. He is professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He's author of numerous books, including the best-selling book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, Keep Your Brain Healthy for the Rest of Your Life. You know, Doctor, when I was thinking about our interview today, I think about so many of these stories that we have heard about, whether it's well-known actors like Charlton Heston or, you know, the late President Reagan that had Alzheimer's. And, you know, all of a sudden this is brought to the forefront. We're living longer, and it's an issue that more and more adults on one side or the other will face in retirement. What can you tell us about this disease? What are the things to look for? And then more importantly, let's get into how we can prevent it.
So Alzheimer's disease is something that happens to people as they get older. In fact, age is the single greatest risk factor. And it's very sad because it robs people of their mind. They lose memory, they can't think straight, and it's a gradually progressive, insidious course. It attacks areas of the brain that control thinking and memory, and it's often difficult to distinguish from normal aging, which is why it becomes so frightening. But to get a handle around how common it is, by age 65 or older, the risk is about 10%, and by 85 or older, it's as high as 50%.
50%? Wow.
So a lot of people feel like they have to throw their arms up and there's nothing they can do, and it turns out that's not the case. Genetics, our inheritance from our parents, only determines part of the risk for the disease. And in fact, for the average person, non-genetic factors are even more important. And that's what our book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, is about, what people can do to keep their brains healthy and possibly stave off the symptoms of the disease in the future.
Doctor, can you explain the difference for our listeners between, let's say, dementia and Alzheimer's? Is a dementia just memory loss? Explain the difference between the two, if you could.
So dementia is memory loss, but also loss of other mental faculties. It can be language ability, it could be a personality change. But to be diagnosed with dementia, that loss has to impair everyday life. So people with dementia need help from others. Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia, and it has this gradual course and insidious onset. And you see these abnormal protein deposits in the brain that build up gradually. But lots of things can cause dementia. People can get dementia from head trauma or from a stroke or from a thyroid imbalance. That might be a treatable dementia. Or depression can cause dementia or a drug side effect. So it's important if somebody has a memory problem that's interfering with their everyday life, they see their doctor.
Let's move on to something, because you said something that caught my attention there, that genetics may determine part of it, but it's other things non-genetically that are more important. And it seems if that's the case, whether it's our environment, our lifestyle, those are the things that perhaps are controllable and we want to focus on.
Yeah, and that's really what the Alzheimer's Prevention Program is about. It provides the science in an understandable way so people understand the connection between their genetic risk and their brain health and their lifestyle. And they're going to be more inclined to live a healthy lifestyle if they know it will protect their brain health and lower their risk for Alzheimer's. And it takes it a step further. It actually details a practical program, what they can do. It translates that science into action. And we have a 7-day jumpstart program in the book that tells people suggestions for what they can eat for meals, gives them exercises that build up over the week, physical exercises, mental exercises, and it offers assessment tools so you can see your progress over the week. And that way people are motivated to continue the program beyond the first week, because to change their brains, to protect their brain health, it's going to take more than just a week.
Doctor, we see this around this time of the year, you know, New Year's resolutions, I'm going to start exercising, I'm going to start dieting. But a lot of times it takes, I think, it's 3 weeks or 21 days to make something habit-forming. How difficult is this, your 7-day program? Is it going to take a lot of effort on one's part? Is this something that can be easily done with a little amount of time, because we live such busy lives today? How practical?
It's very practical. In fact, it only takes about a half hour a day to get started, and after a while it's less than that because you've got the diet worked out. And we've tested it, we've developed it over the years, and we know that it's easy for people to get started. And that's why we detailed it this way, because we knew if people just did it for a week, then they would be convinced. It's not a daunting thing where you have to do it for 90 days. And once you get started, you're motivated to continue. The hardest thing is to get started. But we found by studying people and testing it out that it really does work, and it's easy for people to get started.
You mentioned something about diet. How much does diet play a role in Alzheimer's? In other words, are there certain foods that we shouldn't be digesting? Are there certain kind of foods that we should make a part of our diet? Let's talk about diet for a minute.
Well, diet clearly has an impact. And, you know, one of the first things about diet is to not eat too much. We have an epidemic of overweight and obesity, and that increases your risk for Alzheimer's disease. So we help people with that in terms of trying to maintain and achieve their optimal body weight. But it's also about the kinds of foods you eat. You want to get plenty of anti-inflammatory omega-3 fats from fish, nuts, and flaxseed. You want to also have antioxidant fruits and vegetables in your diet. So colorful berries and green leafy vegetables are very important to protect brain health. Also, we've got to try to minimize the refined sugars and the processed foods, which do not help your brain health. In fact, increase your risk for diabetes. And if you get diabetes, that doubles the probability of developing Alzheimer's.
You know, when you think about that, you know, we used to eat healthy. I guess if we went back maybe more than 100 years ago, when food was grown naturally, people, you know, lived on the farms, we were less city dwellers back then. We seem to have lost that. And if you look at Western society, I remember reading a book called The China Study about the amount of disease that we have in Western societies as a result of our diet. So a diet seems to be like a real key play here. What are some of the other, can you tell us a little bit, what about exercise? What role does that play? And then going back to diet, are there certain things that we digest? You mentioned refined sugars, processed foods. What about alcohol and tobacco?
Well, certainly physical exercise is the most important thing any of us can do. We have the strongest scientific evidence showing that it supports brain health, and you don't have to become a triathlete. Just 20 minutes of brisk walking a day will lower your risk for Alzheimer's. The other thing is that strength training can help as well, and it provides an additional brain benefit beyond
strength training. You're talking weightlifting here?
That's right. There may be something about attending to form offers an additional cognitive exercise, or it may be doing something else physiologically. We know if you're exercising and you're getting some aerobic conditioning, your heart is pumping oxygen and nutrients to your brain cells, and that's critically important for brain health. So those are very important strategies. And, you know, I often talk about the triple threat to Alzheimer's disease is taking a walk with your friend, because what that does, it gives you the cardiovascular conditioning, you're pumping oxygen and nutrients to your brain, you're having a conversation, which provides an additional cognitive benefit, and then talking about your day can lower your stress levels. So you have that too, because we know chronic stress is not good for brain health. I think you mentioned cigarette smoking.
What about tobacco and alcohol?
You know, tobacco is not good for your brain health, and I always recommend that people try to quit if they do smoke. But alcohol, you don't necessarily have to quit, because the studies show that drinking alcohol in moderation, maybe one or two glasses a day, is associated with a lower risk for Alzheimer's. And we're not sure why that is. It could be something in the alcohol that is protecting the brain, or it could be that people that drink in moderation are just more laid back and less stressed out.
You know, you talked about the importance of diet. You talked about exercise. Are there kind of what I call brain exercises? You talk about something. Explain objective recall assessment. What is this and what does it tell you?
So objective recall assessment, we actually have brief assessment tools in the book to help people find out where their baseline is and to show them how they're improving. And what we do is we give you these assessments, and then you can kind of build your memory skills, and you can see improvement. So we have really two kinds of exercises. One kind is just to stimulate your brain circuits, and there's some scientific evidence supporting that, that it actually keeps your brain cells healthier. We don't know for sure, but there's pretty good evidence that that's the case. But there's even better evidence that we can teach you memory techniques, and it will improve your memory very quickly, and the benefits will be sustained for many years. And we teach them in a way that it's very simple, it's easy to learn, and it's very practical. We show how people can improve their everyday memory skills. In fact, the Alzheimer's Prevention Program, for the first time, has specific effective techniques to help with the four most common memory complaints people experience.
Doctor, you have written a number of best-selling books, and explain the difference between the memory prescription, a 14-day plan to keep your brain and body young, and the Alzheimer's Prevention Program, keep your brain healthy for the rest of your life. What's the difference between the two? Is one more comprehensive?
Well, I think, you know, one difference is there's been a lot more research that we've learned from. We've had a lot more practical experience in developing these programs since we wrote the memory prescription. And the memory prescription was really targeted more towards memory improvement. The Alzheimer's Prevention Program is really, even though it includes a lot of those memory techniques and you will improve your memory, it's about overall brain health. It's a way to really change your life so you protect your brain for the long haul.
And I guess as we do a lot more medical research today, we're finding that so much of, let's say, disease prevention and a lot of the common ailments that we have, a lot of it has to do with, let's say, our diets, but also is, to some extent, controlled by the brain.
Yeah, well, I mean, the brain is the key. I mean, if we can achieve brain health, it defines our life. And a lot of people think of brain health as equivalent to just memory. Now, clearly, memory is very important. Without our memory, we have no past, we can't plan for the future, and we can't enjoy the present. But we also need to learn to focus attention. The biggest reason we don't remember is we're distracted and not paying attention. And another component of brain health is thinking and reasoning. And you need memory and you need attention in order to reason and think. And then you need your mood to be in shape. If you're anxious or depressed, you can't pay attention. You can't remember anything. And, of course, memory and all these components of brain health really defines who we are. And it's interesting, you need your brain health to make the right decisions to maintain your brain health, to eat the right diet, to live a healthy lifestyle.
Doctor, is it possible? Let's talk about two things next. What are the signs to be looking out for, let's say, between a husband and wife, where you think maybe one spouse may have the beginning signs of either dementia or Alzheimer's? What are some of the signs to look for, number one, would be my first question. And a follow-up question to that is, if you do have the beginning signs of Alzheimer's, is it reversible? In other words, could they start going through some of the steps in your book and start reversing some of the adverse consequences?
One of the challenges about the early signs of Alzheimer's is that it looks very much like normal aging. We all know that we have memory slips as we age. I think what people should think about is when they're concerned, when it really seems to be affecting their lives. And if they're not sure, get some help. Get someone to take a look at them, go to your doctor, find out about it. Because the earlier you can make a diagnosis, the earlier you can intervene, and it has a bigger impact if you start treating early. Now, how much can you reverse? We certainly can see improvement. We find that we help people with a medical approach who have Alzheimer's disease, and we also combine that with the Alzheimer's prevention program, the lifestyle approach, which seems to add an additional component so they do better in the long run. So I'm always encouraging people to be reasonable, not to run to the doctor with every time they misplace their keys. But if they find that they can't improve with some of the techniques we teach, or if it's really concerning them, try to get help sooner rather than later.
So is it something that, let's say that you go to a doctor, you notice some of these signs, and it's at the very, very early stages. Is it something that you can prolong and improve as a result of, let's say, taking early intervention by either exercise, dieting, memory exercises?
Yeah. Well, we certainly see if people, before they have dementia, we do see definite improvement with the Alzheimer's prevention program. Now, once somebody has dementia, if it's early on and you treat with medicines, you can see some improvement. Not in everyone, but the medicines can improve many people. And if you add the lifestyle approach, we see an even better effect. But it's temporary. We cannot stop this disease once it hits.
So if I'm understanding you correctly and what your book's all about, it's about prevention. In other words, intervene early, change your lifestyle, start doing exercises, and do things that keep your brain healthy. It's no different than, let's say, getting on a proper diet, losing weight, and exercise to keep the body healthy.
Well, it's similar.
You're just basically talking about the brain.
Yeah, it's similar because we have the lifestyle strategies, physical exercise, mental exercise, stress management, and that helps protect your brain cells. But we add the memory techniques to compensate for age-related decline. So you get the whole package. It's a simple way to put it together. And we've looked at the science, and the science is compelling that if you follow this program and you stick with it, you could possibly delay the onset of Alzheimer's symptoms by 2, 3, 4 or more years. Now, for many people, that may mean never getting it for the rest of your life.
Wow. Well, Doctor, as we close, I'm going to give out your book, and I want to just tell our listeners that not only is your book available in paperback form, but it's also available in a Kindle edition. The name of the book is called The Alzheimer's Prevention Program. Keep your brain healthy for the rest of your life, and that's by Dr. Gary Small. Doctor, I want to thank you for coming on the program. Keep up the good work. You're helping a lot of people with the kind of things that you do. I deal with retired folks as my clients are retired, and I often see this tragedy crop up along with dementia. So I was anxious to get you on the program. Thanks so much for the help that you provide other people.
Well, thank you. Very much appreciate it.
All right, folks, we've been speaking once again with Dr. Gary Small, and I highly recommend his book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, Keep Your Brain Healthy for the Rest of Your Life, available in paperback and in Kindle edition at Amazon. Doctor, thanks so much and good talking with you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's Lifetime Income.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.